everyone, and welcome to the Information Entropy Podcast, where we try and take some science, squish it into an hour-long show, hopefully making it less confusing than it was at the beginning. This episode, we are travelling back in time once again, but not to a typical ancient era. This week, it is Japan. If you can follow us on a social media of your choice, that would be fantastic. I'm not going to press you and tell you what to do, where to go. You do you. Most popular place, I would say, or easiest place to find us is probably Instagram, and there you can probably find some interaction as well. I'll stop rambling. I'm Tom Jenks, joined as usual by Mitchell Gatting. How are you, mate?
I'm doing good. You were doing so well to not mention anything, and then you rambled for a long time.
Yeah, you know, I thought sometimes I just have to like jot down exactly what I'm going to say. Yeah. I thought I'd done that, but I hadn't. So, you know, That just happens.
Riffing off the top of your head. What happens.
I always get to the point where I'm like, okay, I've got all our socials listed here. And then I was like, oh, I just need to pick one.
Yeah.
Or not overload the audience with calls to action. Just a quick, like, hey, come help us out.
Just quip.
Whatever it is.
Quip.
Do the algorithm shiz.
Yeah.
And if you don't know what that means, don't worry.
Yeah, don't worry. You probably should know what the algorithm is at this point in this day and age with this technology that we have. We're both a bit tired, to be honest, today. I'm speaking on Tom's behalf because you've been in conferences and I've been at work conferences.
Went to a conference today and back in one day.
Yeah.
But it was a good time. It was a good time. Good to see some stuff, see some people. Exciting times.
Do you get a job from it? Is that how it works? Because that's the only conference that I really know of, like work conferences or like job conferences. But you know, like talk to people, meet people, and that kind of stuff.
No, science conferences are not about getting jobs, really. Unless you're like finishing a postdoc or you're finishing a PhD and you're giving a talk, and at the end you're like, so I'm finishing, if anyone's got a job going. And then maybe people will come up to you at the end and be like, oh, I like your work, and then speak to you about it. But if you think about like university lectures,
yeah,
that's kind of what a conference is. But you have like
multiple,
10 in
multiple
a day.
TED Talks. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Like tiny, like 10, 15 minute ones.
10 TED Talks.
People kind of explain their work and things like that. The projects they're working on.
The most interesting talk that you saw? What was it about?
It was about unexploded ordnances in the North Sea and their impact on the resident dolphin and pinniped population.
That's so niche.
So the conference was specifically about, it was the Underwater Sound Forum, and it's specifically about the propagation of sound underwater. And most people there were there for like policymakers, so a lot of DEFRA people were there and like government people and things like that, but then also a lot of industry and consultants. So they were speaking about if we're pile driving to put sea turbines in, what is the impact going to be on sound propagation throughout the North Sea and the impact on marine mammals and things like that.
I remember you saying
one person was specifically doing a project on unexploded World War II sea mines. Because we find them fairly regularly still in the North Sea, and then someone just has to go over and explode them.
You also find them regularly in people's gardens down where I live. So
yes,
you know.
Yeah, we do. And I thought that was where they came from. But no, they're just ones that they find in the North Sea and they just explode them. Or sometimes they just spontaneously explode. And it shows their impact on, I think it was porpoise behavior specifically they were looking at within like a 10-mile radius, 10-kilometer radius.
Not the porpoise.
The porpoise. I'd say that was the most interesting one, but slightly outside of my line of work, particularly, but not outside of the line of work of everyone else in my lab. So I kind of went along just to meet people.
Just meet people.
Say hello.
Incredibly interesting.
Yeah, as you say, very niche, but if you're into that stuff like we are, then it's a good time. Yeah.
That's true. The most interesting thing that happened at my thing, I can't even say.
Oh.
Not even legally allowed to say.
Okay.
NDAs and clauses all over the show. So that's
Do you want to make it up then? You bought some magic cards. That was
I did also buy some magic cards. Tell everybody. I bought a collector's booster of Magic the Gathering cards, which people don't know the price of them. They're like £25. And then
how many pieces of cardboard do you get?
I believe it's 12 to 13.
Okay, 12 pieces of cardboard for £25.
Yeah, so you're looking at £2-ish each. But then the cards I got out of it were worth like 50, so that's £35 profit.
For you, for anyone opinion. Being like, oh, that's mad, they're really pretty pieces of cardboard.
They are very pretty, or very useful. That's what either drives the price. Is either
they're very
like,
useful in a very specific context.
Yeah. Is that either in modern, which is like the what people play in tournaments, or commander, which is like what people play for fun, but normally the good cards commander are worth a lot of money. Like Oko, the Crown of Thieves or Thieves of Crown or whatever it is. Like, very good in Commander. I'm pretty sure he may be banned in Commander. No, he's not. He's not banned in Commander.
No. Do you know what else is saying happened today?
What?
I ordered a new notebook, which arrived. Because I just finished my other notebook. Four years, right? I've been going through that thing.
Wow.
Every day. I filled every single page. That was an achievement for someone on the neurospicy spicy spectrum. So I was like, do you know what? I'm going to get a fancy one. And it arrived today. Atoms to Astronauts. I am very impressed. Check them out. They're a UK-based company. Not sponsored. However, it's just very cool. Very hyped about my purchase. It was £20. Ooh. Not going to say it wasn't.
Oh, that was spicy for a notebook.
It is spicy for a notebook.
Is it
leather-bound?
They
sent me a free notebook with it. It's faux vegan leather. And so, environmentally sourced.
Vegan leather, then, not faux vegan leather, because that would just be normal leather.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, it's vegan leather. and all the pages are recycled, but actually feel very high quality. And they sent me a free notebook as well.
Oh, that's nice of them.
So I purchased a 180-page A5, and then they also sent me a 48-paged, slightly smaller one for free.
You know, at uni, I went through a phase of like going with like A5 notebooks, like the really diddy ones. Not an A5, below that.
Yeah.
So even smaller, A6. like a pocket notebook.
I'd say the one they sent me free is like a pocket one.
Yeah. Like I essentially rested for the normal when I got down to it. But I started with like an A4 notebook.
Yeah.
And then carrying three of those, because I mean, you only have blocks of like 2 hour, 2 hour, 2 hour. And I had like a full day.
It's a lot.
It got a bit heavy with the laptop and everything. It was not a jam. So I then like condensed into smaller. That's what I got now. Oh, now nice. I just get it from work.
Just get
sponsored ones from work, and they're actually pretty good.
If the paper feels not great, it just grates my teeth as I write. So no, can't be dealing with that. So if anyone else out there is as neurospicy weird as I am, likes good paper, can recommend.
Yeah, I'm not with the pen, not with the paper, but the pen. I'm a bit.
That's my fountain pens.
The pen.
Ugh. I just don't think I've ever written with a good fountain pen.
Why are you trying to write in this day and age with a fountain pen?
Well, I'm not. You were speaking about having like particular writing things, and then that just thought about
when
going
I have
back
to write
to
my estate.
It's just like people egg on fountain pens, right? But like every time I've written with one, it's just not been a good experience because of the scratchiness.
Oh yeah, no, they are 100% scratchy. Uniball 157 is the only pen that anybody ever needs. If you're
that's
there,
literally what I'm holding in my hand right now.
Yeah, if you're out there and you're looking for a good pen, Uniball 157 is the only pen you need.
And coincidentally, it also says on here, made in Japan,
yes.
Which is the topic of today's episode. Uniball also, by the way, now making their pens with recycled sea plastic.
Oh, cool. Are they getting it from the people that dredge it? They're not dredging it because they're not digging it up. But the people that are capturing it at sea...
That is also called dredging.
Is it? I thought dredging had to be like actually like under the floor.
Well, you dredge along the bottom.
Oh, okay. I'm not talking about those people. I'm talking about people that like cast a really wide net.
Oh, I see. Like purse seine netting and things.
Yeah, yeah. When they had like two boats really far apart and they
unsure. It looks like only a specific line are 70%, 75% recycled plastic. This is getting worse. Okay, it's called the Ocean Care Pen. 75% of it is recycled plastic, of which only 10% of that is ocean waste. So, I got sold there.
Oh, you're duped slightly. Was it called greenwashing?
Well, no, they're still doing it. It's just that they put a really big percentage on this, the it being ocean waste, when really that's only 7.5%. But still, it's not nothing. So no. Anyway,
not nothing. They're trying.
We've gone down the rabbit hole of random shit. So why don't I kick you into the news and see what you've got for us this week?
This week, I decided to go with some like bee news. I thought the bees would be it. So
I've seen a few this year already.
Yeah, they're coming out. I got hit in the head by one. They're a bit dopey at sometimes, and I just like thunk. Didn't sting me or anything.
I don't know what it is about George's like the area like we sit in the living room, I suppose. But one of the windows, like at least once a week, a bee just thunks into the window, and yeah. It cracks me up every single time.
it's just satisfying noise they make. It's like
a thunk.
Yeah. So this bee news comes from two individuals that were studying bees. So bee biologist Sabrina Rondeau and Nigella Rain, they were studying hibernating queen bees. And what they were doing is they were seeing how, if they were hibernating, how they would respond to pesticide exposure. So they had a condensation in the refrigerator storing the dormant bees in the lab at the university in Canada, which was an accident. And it caused four of the vials, because that's what they were using to make sure that it was like a same environment for all of them. It caused all four vials of which had the queen bees in them to flood, unfortunately.
Yeah, I did see this news. Very exciting.
Yeah, so right here was a... Funny said that she was very concerned at first, and she thought obviously they were dead because they had drowned them in a vial with nowhere for them to go. But to her surprise, after they were picked up with forceps and then dried off a little bit in the air, they started fidgeting and actually were alive. So then they decided to do more rigorous testing around how waterproof bumblebee queens are. They had 143 common eastern bumblebee queens left over from another experiment, which, if you didn't know, bees are commercially available, so they weren't collected from the wild. And 17 queens were put into a controlled environment and weren't submerged in water, while the others were submerged and left floating on the surface for 8 hours, 24 hours, and 1 week in those different time spacings. And all the bees were housed in individual vials and stored at cold hibernation temperatures. And this was meant to mimic possible real-world flooding scenarios where a queen's hibernation chamber could potentially be filled with water or only partially submerged. And how often that happens is currently unknown, but they wanted to know what the output would be. So the observation of the bumblebees overwintering in the wild was scarce, but queens being found to generally prefer sloped grounds and sandy soils. So those wouldn't be prone to flooding, but even so, they wanted to see what would actually happen. It turns out that the four queens who survived accidental fridge flooding were hardly outliers. They weren't anomalies. Of the 21 queens that were submerged for 7 days and then allowed to resume hibernating, 17 were still alive 8 weeks after the aquatic ordeal. So, you know, that was how many? Three passed away.
Yeah, I think it was like 80% or something they said in the paper.
Yeah, absolutely 80%. And they survived, were said to,
by the way.
Yeah, survived. So they were said that they would look, they were described as wet and dripping, like they were a bit damp, and then they came out. But after some time, they were fluffy, like you would imagine them being, and like nothing had happened. So, yeah, they said this is a first like stepping stone into doing some more research into some deeper places regarding water and bees and being able to survive things like that, but they said it was a surprising find.
Yeah, it's wild because, like, it just shows you sometimes science accidental things really lead to some like wild discoveries. Like, oh, actually, yeah. Bees can live underwater for a week if they really need to whilst they're hibernating. Yeah, crazy, really cool. Of course, it's only confirmed for this one species at the minute, but it would make sense that it would also be present in other species as well, yeah. Right?
It wouldn't make sense if it was just them.
No. But yeah, that's really cool. Well, I remember reading that going, that's got to be the news this week. I forgot to tell you. So you found it yourself. So yeah. good job.
Yeah.
You did it.
I just went, you did it.
Hey. All right. So this week, if we eventually get into the topic, we are looking at ancient civilizations. So if you've been following us the past few weeks, you'll know about this already. And this is where we're looking at choosing a civilization in history at some point, giving a bit of a background, exploring advances in science and technology that they introduced to the world. So we've covered Egypt. We didn't get onto the pyramids in the first episode, so we had to go back to that. covered Rome, and then this week will be Japan. But do you know what my first question was when I was researching this?
What was it?
Why do we refer to ancient Egypt, ancient Rome, and not some other civilizations? Why have I never heard of ancient Japan before? So this is the first thing that I looked at.
That's right, because I... the way that I've heard it described is either ancient Japan or feudal Japan.
The feudal period is fairly recent. Within 1,000 years, right?
Yes. But that's when they were, you know, things were kicking off, and they were things were getting done. But I don't know. I would call it ancient Japan and have heard it called ancient Japan, so I don't know.
So what I found out was the primary reason is just due to the relatively late start of the written records in Japan compared to the previously discovered written records of the ancient civilizations like Rome, Greece, Egypt. They developed writing, and the records have just survived a lot longer. In Japan, the written record begins with the introduction of the Chinese characters known as kanji, which occurred around the 5th century AD. So writing has only been practiced heavily in Japan for the past 1,500 years. Whereas when we speak about ancient Egypt, we're actually speaking about, you know, nearly 7,000 years ago. 6,000. So there's a lot of a time difference there. So we don't really have a massive record, at least a written one, of what happened in Japan before that time. It's mostly archaeological finds. It's oral, it's archaeological evidence. So the historical period before the introduction of the written records, the 5th century AD, is often referred to as prehistoric or proto-historic Japan. And that's why we very rarely hear it called ancient Japan, because we don't really know what happened in what we would define the ancient times, which I think you can safely say is before, you know, anything BCE, before the current era, anything year zero BCE, or before.
One era or BCE.
So there are some eras of Japan that I looked at to kind of get us, you know, from the ancient era, because I was wondering what actually happened back then. Did you look at this at all?
Yeah, I did like a brief introduction to the history of Japan. This is one of those things that we looked at. And there are six different periods that actually exist.
Yes. Oh, I got nine. But I had to go digging for some of the more recent ones. But go with your six.
I'm doing the periods of like ancient Japan. I'm not being like, what was it this year?
No, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. So the first... period that they've got is 14,000 to 300 BCE, known as the Jomon period. It's categorized by its early pottery, which is among the oldest in the world. The people during this time were mainly hunter-gatherers with rich spiritual life, as evidenced by the numerous clay figurines and pottery that was found. You then had the Yayoi period. I hope that I've pronounced that right.
I was about to say, I should have caveated this at some point. It's been like the pronunciations of some of the things are going to be awful.
Normally, when it comes to reading Japanese, I'm better at this than like French or Spanish, because I've read more Japanese names in my adult life than like French names. Purely because I read way too much manga. So this period, which is from 300 BCE to 300 CE, this era saw the introduction of wet rice agriculture brought by migrants from the Korean Peninsula. The Yoi period marked significant technological and social changes, including the beginning of the social stratification and the formation of the proto-state structures. You then have the Kofun period, which is 300 to 538 CE, named after the large tomb mons Kofun built for the elite. This period was categorized by the emergence of powerful chieftain small kingdoms. It was during the Kofun period that the foundation of the Japanese state begins to emerge, particularly under the influence of the Chinese culture and technology through Korea. You then have the Asaka period. The introduction of Buddhism in the mid-6th century marks the Asaka period, influencing Japanese culture, art, and politics. The Asaka period also saw the codification of laws and the establishment of culture administration under the influence of the Chinese Confucian models. There is 100% an outtake from Anchorman 2 that I was going to quote, but if you don't know the quote, it sounds awful, so I'm not going to do it. You then got the Nara period, which is 710 to 794 CE, and this is the first permanent caste was established in Nara, known as Heijikaiyo. The Nara period is marked by the flourishing of Japanese culture, including the creation of the earliest works of Japanese literature, such as the Kojiki and the Nihon Shoki. The establishment of Buddhism as the state religion led to the construction of large temples, such as the Tadeji. Then you've got the Heian period, which is 794 to 1185 CE, and following the move of the capital to Heian-kaiyo, also modern name is Kyoto, so Kyo, Heian-kaiyo. The Heian period is also known for its court culture and arts, epitomized by the novel of the Tale of Genji by Murasaki Shikibu. This era also saw the rise of the powerful aristocratic families such as the Fujiwara and the beginning of the samurai class's rise to power. And then there's three more that Tom's got.
Yeah, so after that, I've got the Kamakura period, 1185 to 1333. This began with the establishment of the Kamakura shogunate by Minamoto no Yoritomo after his victory in the Genpei War, which marked the end of the Heian period. So this was the first shogunate in Japan. If anyone's been watching Shogun, this is kind of where that whole thing kind of starts to arise. If we start thinking of, feudal Japan is one of the most famous eras in Japanese history, especially from a historical and Western studying point. And this is essentially leading up to that period. So effectively, the shogunate shifted the political power from the imperial court to the warrior class, or the samurai, as we know them. The period ended with the collapse of the Kamakura shogunate due to the internal power struggles and external invasions, leading to the transition to the Muromachi period, which ran from 1336 to 1573. This period began with the establishment of the Muromachi shogunate by Ashikaga Takuaji, who overthrew the previous shogunate, essentially. And this is considered the height of Japan's feudal era. So during this time, Japan was ruled by a military government, referred to as the Bakufu. The shogun served as a de facto ruler, but a singular one. So feudalism here was very prevalent, with power decentralized among regional warlords known as the daimyo, who controlled their territories through systems of vassalage and land grants. So you can think of this as you have one person at the top, and it was kind of like, England, I suppose, at one point during the medieval era, you had the king, and then they handed out lords and lands who would then preside over those regions. That's essentially what you had here with the shogun and the daimyo. And then you have the Sengoku period from 1467 to 1603. This was still feudal era Japan, but known as the Warring States period, characterized by nearly constant military conflict and political instability. Daimyo competed for power and territory, leading to widespread warfare across Japan, and saw the rise of powerful warlords such as Oda Nobunaga and others, who I'm not going to try and pronounce. So despite the chaos of war, the Sengoku period also saw significant social and economic changes, including the rise of the merchant class and the development of castle towns. So this also saw the demise, as it were, of the feudal Japan, which I just think of as such an interesting period of history, which I wish I had the chance to study more. But
yeah, it's one of those things that Westerners and outside people didn't really have an insight into because they didn't open their borders essentially to anybody for the longest of time. They wouldn't trade outwards. They locked themselves off. Actually, if anyone's watched Shogun recently, you'll find like you've got the Spanish are trying to get in, and the Americans are trying to get in, and the Portuguese are trying to get in to find ways of trading. Very interesting.
Yeah, for nearly 200 years, it was closed off by the Shogunate. So in the past couple of areas that I mentioned there, and it was forced by the Sakoku policy to remove colonial and religious influence of primarily Spain and Portugal.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, though, that didn't particularly work. But yes, that ended in 1853, actually, so fairly recently.
Yeah, that's what I mean about like how much we know of them and their history is fairly recent because of those reasons.
And I guess maybe that's an influence as to why they have such a, not guarded culture, but certainly one that's a lot more established than it feels like we do here in the West. Does that make sense? More protected culture.
Yeah, no, I would agree with that. Okay. It's not they're anti-foreigners, but there it's one of those things where if you can, you'll always be treated as an outsider. I watch a lot of things about like how to emigrate to Japan, like foreigners in Japan, and one of the things that they always comment on is like, even if you like integrate and you've lived there for like 20 years, if you aren't Japanese by descent, you're still treated like an outsider. Right. I think like that's ingrained in them to like keep their culture theirs, and you know, all the things that they do is very much theirs, which
yeah,
you know, if it's built into that, it's who they are, then that's fine.
Yeah, that's fair. All right, what have you got for us then? What's the topic you would like to dive into?
First thing I went for, well, I've got some facts, mate.
Oh, of course. Yeah, halfway through the show. Let's get through our opening things properly.
Actually, no, I'm not going to do facts. Oh, okay, I've got a couple of facts. Metallurgy, the crafting of samurai swords, involved unique steel forging techniques, producing blades of unmatched arts of resilience. I'll talk about that in a second. The timekeeping, water clocks were a thing. I'm going to speak a bit about that as well. They were used in temples to mark time with remarkable accuracy. And some road construction. The layout of ancient Japanese roads and bridges showcased advanced engineering that facilitated trade and communication. You didn't know?
Well, I did not.
Yeah. So, well, there's also some water engineering. The Japanese engineers created intricate irrigation systems using bamboo water wheels, which was vital for their rice farming.
That makes sense. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was like using what they had at the time, which is like a lot of bamboo. So like,
so much bamboo.
Cutting it in half gave you like, or hollowing it out gave you pipes.
Right,
like
of course,
pre-built pipes or guttering, if you will, like just in, grass. If you didn't know, that's what bamboo is.
Yes.
The fastest growing,
very quick.
Plant?
I was about to say. Yeah, it's. I think it, there's one that grows like a foot a day.
Yes, and the reason for it is the cell structure is all built, and then it essentially just inflates. Isn't that right?
The Madake and Moso are some of the fastest growing bamboo variants, which can grow an inch per hour.
Which is crazy to think. There's a plant that you can just go away to lunch, come back, you're like, oh, like good growth.
Get on your son.
Yeah. Because there's like wild. There's rumors of like farmers trying to sleep at night with their bamboo fields, or the bamboo being close to that, and then being able to hear it, like stretching and growing. Yeah, because when there's so much around, it's not just one. You've got like a whole, I don't know, about a bushel of bamboo. I don't know what.
Yeah, a bushel. I'll take it.
Yeah, you could hear it.
That's wild.
Yeah, I wonder what the actual reason is. rhizome.
Well, you'd imagine like a big, even something that makes a minuscule sound. When you got lots of them in a single place, right? You'd think some sound would be produced there.
Yeah.
Unknown.
Bamboo shoots are connected to their parent plant by an underground stem called a rhizome. This means the shoot doesn't need any leaves of its own until it reaches full height. Bamboo's all green. Yeah. Yeah, it's essentially, it has everything pre-built in it, and then it just inflates with water.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah, all the cells are already there.
Yeah, they're already there.
They're just being pumped up. It's not so like they need to grow.
They grow a ton of complicated cells before it makes it out of the ground. Then an extensive root system absorbs tons of water to inflate those pre-built cells straight into the sky. Yeah.
Wild.
Absolutely crazy stuff. Okay, but moving on. So the first thing I picked, because who doesn't like a samurai sword? So is the technology and the science behind the art of steel folding, which is the art of folding steel is traditional Japanese sword making. It's a highly revered technique that's been perfected over centuries. It was crucial for crafting legendary samurai swords known as katanas. The meticulous process involves several detailed steps, each contributing to a superior quality and unique characteristic of sword. So, the purpose of steel folding, the primary purpose of folding the steel, known as shita kaite, is to refine the steel's quality. This is achieved by removing impurities and evenly distributing carbon content throughout the blade, which enhances both its strength and flexibility. The folding process allows for a combination of the hard and soft steel layers, ensuring the sword can maintain sharpness while also being resistant to breaking during combat, which is you don't want to be like trying to stab someone and then hitting your sword and your sword breaking in half. That's not what you want.
It's not a good time.
It's not a good time for you. So techniques and
bear in mind, this was happening like 600 years ago.
More than that.
Even more than that.
Which,
no, not 1,000, but there are some very old katanas around.
Yes, and some like masters that just out incredible. So techniques that impacted sword quality. The steel often started from a material called tamahagane. Is repeatedly folded, heated, folded, and hammered. This not only helps it eliminate impurities, but also aligns the grain of the steel, creating alternating layers of differing hardness and toughness. Such structuring is crucial because it contributes to the blade's resilience, holding, and an ability to hold a hard edge, which isn't the same as just being able to keep its shape. So typically the steel is folded anywhere from 10 to 20 times, which can produce thousands of thin layers. Because if you double, then double, then double, then double, then double. Well, not double, it's squaring, isn't it? Yeah, when you square, you can get to 1,000 very quickly. Yeah, I
doubling on itself repeatedly.
Yes, you're correct. Yeah, it's doubling. I was right first. So you double. So he can produce thousands of thin layers significantly quickly. But strength and aesthetic appeal, because it looks very, 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 very cool. The grain pattern is known as jihada. Looks very cool. It's not quite Damascus steel.
That came slightly later.
Yeah,
and it's a folding of different process.
We don't know, Tom. The how to make Damascus steel, the techniques lost to time. We don't know how to do it.
I don't know, mate. You can buy them off Amazon.
They're fake. All fake. Wannabes. Not true Damascus.
Yeah.
And then you have the cultural and historic significance. So beyond their practical applications in warfare, these swords carry immense cultural and historical significance, symbolizing the samurai's honor and discipline. The aesthetic qualities of the blade, such as a distinct pattern and the specific curvature, are not only functional, but also represent the zenith of Japanese craftsmanship and artistic expression. They're just cool, and they're awesome.
They're just cool.
Yeah.
What I like about this is you explain they're folding things and it's giving it like unique structure and they're getting all the layers in. And all I could think about was, okay, so the French went for pastry, folding croissants.
Yeah, yeah. Getting the butter
to get their layers. Yeah. Their layers. So apparently, just folding things works really well.
Yeah, you'd be surprised.
From pastry to swords.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
I also look at what advantages, because I was like, in warfare, surely, if they decided to not stay on the Japanese peninsula and went like Korea or came south, like try to go to Australia, surely at that time they would have just absolutely destroyed people because their swords were better than anything anybody else had. because they can just like chop through it. So I had a look at like what advantages this provide. First is enhanced strength and flexibility, what I said before. So repeating folding and forging the steel removes impurities, helps the distribution of carbon throughout the blade, which made it very strong and flexible, which is a crucial combination for combat effectiveness, because it could withstand impact without breaking while maintaining a sharp edge, was, you know, highly advantaged in battle. In prolonged battles, you have something called Edridge tension. So the high carbon steel used in the outer layers of the sword, achieved through the folding process, allowed the blade to maintain a very sharp edge over a long period of time in battle. So it's one of those things where other swords, especially how we made them, as in the Brits in medieval time, they didn't take that into account. So you would get dings, cuts into it, grooves, the edge would be dented and destroyed. And over a large period of time, you had to, like, there's a lot of maintenance went into our swords. Like, we got a lot of grind wheels, that kind of thing. I'm not saying they didn't take care of their katanas, but the fights impacted them less.
Yes, because they were just a much higher quality.
Yeah, much higher quality. You'd have one in a family, essentially, which would be passed down to, you know, sons that whoever was going to war. If they came back, it would then be passed down. If they came back, it would then be passed down. That kind of thing. So yeah, I said resilience of wear and tear. The structure created by the folded steel provided significant advantages in longevity, durability. The alternating layers of hard and soft help prevent the blade from becoming brittle and fracturing within the core of the blade, which is common with simpler forging techniques that we used. And then there's the symbolic and psychological impacts of why they were cool. they're curved. It was distinctive appearance. You would know what it is just from the get-go and who you could see it. You could then very quickly identify like the quality of it, because the known sword and sword makers had a distinct style of the sword. So if you saw somebody with some like a very, very expensive katana on the battlefield, so you'd instantly be like, yeah, maybe we just avoid that individual.
Yeah, he's got a rare sword.
Yes, yeah. it's a gold rare katana. Ignore that. But they were incredibly expensive to even for in that era to buy, because the required craftsmanship is you would have maybe less than 10 master craftsmen. Like, I think now there's only like 2 or 3 left that have like been officially sanctified as master craftsmen to be able to make katanas to a proper as they were. There's a very interesting guy that I follow on TikTok who is an Englishman who is doing like blacksmithing in Japan. And he just follows everything that it does, and it's all very much as they did back then. Because that was like the way of doing it. And also it's still really good. Like the way that
that's why they're 600 years old and still fine.
Yes. Yeah, indeed.
Yeah. What I find really interesting is obviously like if you speak like over here, like you said, we made swords in a certain way, and you know, we had lots of international, I'd say, like warfare, but also internal warfare. But like Japan was somewhat a bit more isolated, right? And they kind of went down one route that, you know, katanas allowed for quick warfare at the same time. You know, one of the things about having a katana, you can get it out of its sheath and cut someone within a single movement, right? Whereas you look at medieval like Europe, and it's more like big hulking things that were going to come at you because we're in bloody tin suits and things like that. Like the different routes of weaponry and the style that they went down in their kind of isolated regions is also incredibly interesting.
Yes. It's called a sire, by the way. Not a
sire.
A scabbard or sheath. It's a sire.
Sorry. Yep. Yes. Very cool.
Yeah. There's also like you have a long one and a short one. I can't remember what the short one's name is.
The Shoto.
Yeah. Which
I do believe it's a Shoto. Yeah.
Just more of a
It's very cool.
Decorative piece, but also very useful.
Yeah, I mean it's still a functioning blade.
Yeah, it's still like cut a man's head off, but you know. Dear me. Just researching it, it's just like I just want to get a wool and fill it with cool swords, and then I would also fill it with cool swords from anime. Like if anyone's ever watched Bleach out there, there's a lot of cool swords in that anime. And then yeah.
When I was home a few weeks ago, I brought my sword back up. I have a sword from the Lord of the Rings.
Oh yeah, you do.
Yeah. Back when I had what I thought was a very disposable income.
When I thought I had disposable money.
Yes.
You don't want disposable money. It's just a slippery slope into spending money on things that you definitely 100% don't need.
Or you do, and you can just like nerd math your way into needing it.
Yeah.
It's
cool. There was like a trend a while ago that was like girl math, boy math.
Yeah.
Yeah, girl mathing something. Got into the girl math thing and was like, yeah, I understand that. It's good. Like if you get a, what's it called? Like a refund to something, or you get expenses and the money comes back. It's just free money. You can spend it on what
it's
you
free
want.
Money. It's free money. And then you basically buy something else and it's essentially free.
Yeah, because you didn't have that money. So that money coming in is just free money.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I can too easily do that to myself. It's dangerous.
100%. I've done it a lot
today. I walked
recently
into a board game shop because I was like, oh, I'll just walk in here. And you never know. I bought expansion for a game.
Oh, mate.
To be fair, I'd only found it in German online, so it wasn't.
I did that years ago with a game called Zombies with 3! And I was like, well, online it's like 60 quid, but in this store it's 10. Like, just free money.
Oh, I mean, you could basically buy six of those expansions.
Yeah.
And just have a good time.
I know, it was the full game. Just be like, I could resell this at any point and make money.
Yeah. Fair. Free money.
It's just free money.
It's just free. One of the things I looked at was, obviously, Japan is a region of the world that exhibits a lot of seismic activity. And obviously, that's not a recent thing.
No.
So I was wondering how they dealt with that back in the day. So that's what I did.
Lots of wood.
And I've got that information for you.
Lots
of wood.
Lots of
bamboo.
Wood. Lots of wood and bamboo.
Time.
Yeah. Bamboo scaffolding.
So yes, wooden construction was certainly one of the traditional tools that they use. So traditional Japanese architecture often utilized wood as the primary building material. It's a lightweight and flexible, obviously we know what wood is, but this allows structures to sway and absorb the energy of seismic waves without collapsing. Now, of course, back in the day, they didn't know what earthquakes were. However, they knew that they happened, right? The ground's going to shake at some point and knock things down, so we need to build accounting for that. Additionally, a lot of wooden joints, so carpentry in Japan, or I think Japanese carpentry worldwide is renowned,
yeah,
for being ultra precise and just incredible.
Stuff.
Like
no nails.
A lot of the stuff that I, yes, exactly. That's what I was about to say.
No nail carpentry is being absolutely crazy.
Yeah, they are absolutely nuts with the joints that they can make between two pieces of wood and just like, yeah, nails. Who needs them? Who needs them? But they would actually build some joints and connections that were designed to allow for the movement of the building and the flexibility of them. So that reduced the risk of structural damage during earthquakes. But what's wild to me is that obviously they had to think about that on the entire building level. So what part of the building is going to move? How is that going to impact this joint specifically? And then you had, I presume, a team of carpenters producing the wood for this building. And that would have to be overseen by someone. So immense calculations going on back in the day to account for these things, which is really cool. You also had just some standard earthquake-resistant designs known as Kasuga Zukuri, which is traditional Japanese buildings incorporating specific earthquake-resistant features to enhance their stability. This could include a style of architecture commonly found in shrines and temples known as Kasuga Zukuri. It often utilizes a central pillar known as a Shinbashira that is allowed to sway independently of the surrounding structure. This design helps dissipate seismic energy and reduce the risk of structural damage. So a central pillar, taking a lot of the load, but also dissipating and being allowed to like sway around without disrupting the solid structure that's around it. And foundation designs as well. So in a lot of earthquake-prone regions, buildings were often constructed with deep foundations that were designed to withstand ground movement. So traditional Japanese building would employ techniques such as stone or timber pile foundations. And these distribute the building's weight evenly across a deeper surface area, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
And this would minimize the risk of settlement or subsidence underneath that.
Subsidence.
Fair. That honestly, it makes sense. I could have gone either way there. I was on the fence as I was reading it. Subsidence.
It's not even a Japanese word, Tom.
No. Well, I struggle with English as it is.
Just too
much writing going on these days. Yeah, maybe that as well. I don't know. Yeah, no, I think even as in English, I would have read that as is. I'm Googling it.
It's subsidence. So houses sink. I'm pretty sure that my current house has subsidence because there's a lot of cracks that are appearing all around the roof.
Yeah, subsidence. Is that not what I said? What did I say? Subsidence.
Subsidence, yeah.
What a tit. Okay, yeah, subsidence. Wow, okay. And then obviously this is a practice that's had to stay even into modern times. So many historic buildings in Japan have undergone seismic retrofitting to improve their resilience to earthquakes. This may include stuff like adding additional bracing to internal and external structures, reinforcing structural elements, or even installing base isolators to decouple the building from the ground motion. So you can essentially put the building on like a base plate, which is allowed to move independently of the ground. So
crazy stuff going on with magnets.
And probably lasers as well, because they're involved in everything.
And lasers, just everywhere. Yeah. Yeah, if you watch, there's like some YouTube channels that show off Japanese like architecture and how it's implemented other places in the world. And like only in, what's it called? Miniature form. But they've got the magnets and like the anti-rockers going up, and they show like, this is what it would be without, and it just collapses. And they're like, this is what it is with it. And it's sort of like wobbling, but it doesn't fall down.
That's why Little Red Riding Hood would never took place in Japan.
Yeah, I was thinking of more those toys. Wibble Wobbles, where they don't fall down.
No.
It can't be like before your time. I can't wonder what they're called.
I'm pretty sure my time was before your time.
Only by a little
Wibble
bit.
Wobble toys.
But they don't fall down.
Weeble Wobbles?
Yeah, Weeble Wobbles, but they don't fall down.
Weeble Wobbles, yeah, okay, those I know. Some of those are absolutely horrifying to look at.
They are. They really are.
They're terrifying. Oh, my Lord. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, I'm going to not look at those anymore. I'm going to have nightmares. What else have you got?
What else have I got? So, yeah. I had a think back into things that I'd looked at or videos that I've spent hours watching about something really niche to do with Japan. So I had a look at the ink, Japanese ink, and then
I also looked at this, yeah,
paper as well, because they were also known for they're making paper in a specific way, which I thought was quite interesting. But there is a 2-hour video that if you want to watch about Japanese ink on YouTube, and it is incredibly interesting the whole way through. But traditional Japanese ink known as sumi represents a pinnacle of craftsmanship in the world of calligraphy. It's characterized by its creation process that blends artistry with precise scientific technology. The production of sumi, it has such interesting way of using chemicals, and like the physical process that it uses is just incredible and really illustrates how ancient techniques have been preserved while meeting the high standards of purity and functionality that is demanded by traditional Japanese calligraphy. Because if you didn't know, calligraphy ink isn't just normal ink. It has to be thicker, dry in a specific way, has to work with calligraphy brushes that are very, very special.
Not like rabbit hair.
Yeah, possibly.
I think it was another type of hair.
Yeah.
They use...
I thought about buying one of those brushes that are a single hair for like miniature painting for doing the eyes. Hair. It's a single hair, and it's to do the eyes.
Oh.
That hyperfixation quickly went out the window. So, a bit of historical context and significance around Sumi ink. Started dating back to the 17th century when it was introduced from China. By the 10th century, it became a fundamental element of Japanese culture, primarily used in calligraphy and painting. The city of Nara became a central hub for Sumi production due to the availability of high-quality soot and the local mastery of intricate production techniques. So, one of the things that sets it apart, really, from other ink is during its like production process, the raw materials collection, the first step of producing Sumi is the collection of soot. And the soot is obtained from the smoke of burning vegetable oils, such as rapeseed and sesame, or pine wood. And you essentially, well, firstly, the choice of burning material affects the quality and characteristics of the soot produced, which in turn affects and influences the quality of the final ink stick, because when you get the ink in Sumi, it comes as a hard stick that you use water and you rub it on a special plate, and that produces the ink that you then use. The soot particles are collected on ceramic or metal surfaces placed above a burning material, and this collection process is meticulous to ensure the purity of the soot. Like, you have someone in there all day, every day, monitoring how much soot is being put onto the bottom. So if you imagine you have an open flame, it's like a, what's it called, a brazier, burning, and then you will have a upside down bowl put on top that the flame is burning into and creating that soot. And what they'll do is they'll keep refilling the fuel of these flames perpetually over a long time to create as much soot as they can. And then they'll come through and they'll use a brush to get the soot out of the bowl. And then that goes into the next processes, which is the mixture. So once the soot is collected, it's mixed with a binder, normally made from animal glue, which is called nakiwa, which is derived from collagen in animal skins. This mixture also occasionally includes aromatic substances to enhance the ink's smell. Sometimes they put gold in it. There's a whole different, like, if you want to spend a lot of money on it, you can go full off the spectrum with whatever you want. And the way that it's because part of the video that's on YouTube, I will have to find the name of it and post it. Is they go through like collection of soot, putting it in, like preparing it with how they actually mix it. And it's a guy essentially, because it's so hard, you can't really use your hands. So you essentially use your feet to like pound this ink, which is in a like globule like state.
Is it the video by Business Insider?
Oh, it could be.
Why Japanese calligraphy is so expensive. Japanese calligraphy ink is so expensive. And literally the first second of the video is some guy stomping on this black mess.
Yeah. So expensive. Business Insider. Is this it? A year ago. Yes! Yeah, it is. Oh, no, this is a shortcut. This is the short version. 12 minutes long.
Yeah.
But okay. Yeah, this does like, yeah. So
if you don't have 2 hours, yeah, this will do you.
Essentially, he stamps it to initially get the hardness. It's this weird jelly-like state. You then ram it into a mold, which, you know, it takes quite a while to get into. It then gets stamped with the manufacturer, and that's essentially a seal of approval, which then creates these ink sticks. And then they're, you know, put in a dried environment, a controlled environment, so that it can dry properly. So it's not just like a glue stick when you sell it. It's then covered in a layer of ash. The ash acts as a desiccant, absorbing moisture evenly from the ink and preventing it from cracking or warping as it dries. So the drying process is lengthy and can vary from a few months to several years. Longer drying periods are used for higher quality ink as they allow for more gradual evaporation of the moisture, which enhances the ink's consistency and durability. So during drying, the ink sticks may be moved to different environments to control the rate of moisture loss. So that's just absolutely wild to know that you can be like, yeah, we've got to put it in this warehouse because the gradient of moisture loss we want higher in this one, so the durability is better. It is then polished to achieve a smooth and appealing surface that grinds well on ink stones. Yeah, which is what I said, they rub it against.
I see what you mean about the little cookers now, and some guy is just in this room.
Yeah, just all day.
With the fires. Just, oh, he's got a little COVID-19 mask on, though.
Yeah, 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 because some of the flames and the oils that they use is, like, highly carcinogenic.
Yeah.
Like, just really bad for your lungs.
That does not look... As an asthmatic, that's giving me anxiety.
Yeah. But once they've got it... So, if they tie them up as well, this is really quite, I find quite interesting. When they're drying, they've got this technique where they use like dry reeds, and they hang them vertically, so they make them really easy to transport. It's just absolutely, get lost in the sauce with this. The chemical and physical properties of it, pivotal to its functionality in calligraphy. The quality of soot, which consists mainly of carbon particles, defines the depth and permanence of the black color produced. The particle size of the soot and its distribution within the binder matrix significantly affects the ink's opacity and the sharpness of the lines that it can produce. So the interaction between ink and paper is also crucial. The binder, largely composed of gelatinous proteins, must be capable of absorbing into the paper without bleeding, yet sufficient to bind the carbon particles to the paper surface effectively. This interaction is influenced by the pH of the ink and the ionic strengths of the components, which can affect the ink's stability and how it ages over time. So there's a lot going on. It's not just here's some ink that we've made, it's just crazy. Absolutely crazy.
I mean, it's completely wild, isn't it, considering like the resources they would have had to like put this all together and actually just refine this process over time, you know, hundreds of years ago. Matt, I mean, no wonder why ink was so expensive.
Yeah,
back in the day.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to watch this video again. It's just absolutely mesmerizing. Look at it's one of the things that you the craftsmanship of everything like at this level is like the care and attention that's put into every single thing is like why it's so utterly successful. Everything that is done is just crazy.
I feel like that's somewhat Japan in a nutshell, right?
Yeah.
The attention to detail putting into everything.
Yes, 100%.
This is one of those things I could put on and fall asleep to, you know?
I hate that you do that.
If anyone's listened to the show for a while, you know that that is the highest praise that I could give.
Seal of approval. Is Tom,
seal of approval.
Tom Bedworthy.
I can watch it whilst going to sleep. Oh, you've got me. I will just queue all those videos up and you're making money.
Yeah, there's another video and it's to do with... there's a Michelin star restaurant in Japan where there's like he only has like six chairs at the, I can't remember what the name of it is, but it's one of those where you see them prepare the sushi, and it essentially just follows him in the morning to when he's outside preparing the stuff, and I just like would pay to go have some like wagyu beef there.
I'll make it to Japan at some point.
Yeah.
It's on the list.
It's on the list, possibly on the horizon, but not like Tokyo or Osaka. It would be more a snowboarding location, which would be equally as cool. Into the north. There's one place I was looking at, it was just like, it snows 168 days of the year. And I'm not talking like, you know, it snowed a bit down here in Plymouth. I'm talking... It snows. Like, it just absolutely crazy stuff.
Yeah, it's a really good, ski and snowboard seasons out there. But I think if you're going that far, it would also be completely fair and valid to go and see the rest of it as well.
Yeah, that's true. One of the things I was looking at I thought was incredibly cool was the technology they use for keeping the roads clear. I think we talked about this before, about that where they pump water out onto the roads.
Right.
To stop.
Oh, they have like a constant stream.
Yeah, constant
stream
so it can't settle or freeze.
Yeah, that's pretty nuts. Pretty nuts.
Mm-hmm. Oh, what time are we at? Oh, we're at 60 minutes. I have so much more.
Yeah.
I've got more. I have water clocks and the paper for the ink to go onto. This is known as washi. Washi? Washi?
Washi.
Washi. Washi. Probably washi.
If it's Japanese, probably washi, I was going to say.
Mm-hmm.
Like yoshi.
That's fair.
No.
That's fair. Yeah, that's fair.
Oh, dear. Losing the plot. Is there anything you do want to sneak in before we...
Nothing that I can easily sneak in. Like, we've got Rikoku. Japanese water clocks, but that's the whole thing.
Yeah, they're pretty intense.
They're pretty intense.
A good time.
Yeah, we may have to do another session on this, to be honest, because I've got a lot going on. I think you've only spoken about one thing. I monologued for an hour.
Well, that's because I also looked at swords and ink. So we've also covered everything I had. we lined up very well on what we independently looked at there. Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll come back to this at some point. Maybe next week. We'll keep you in the loop. I guess you'll find out when you come and find us next week. So yes, that will bring us to a wrap. Don't forget to share this with your friends, families, whoever will be interested. We want them to listen. You can find us on the socials that we may or may not use. The website formerly known as Twitter and TikTok. We're at InfoEntropyPod. Instagram, we're InformationEntropyPod. That's probably the best place to find us. And I think the artwork looks pretty nice this week, if I say so, Mitch. Thank you for that one. Oh. And of course, if you're listening on Spotify, iTunes, wherever you are listening, if you can give us a like, rating, a follow, comment, algorithm stuff, it helps. And we appreciate it massively. Anything for you to shout out? My good sir.
No, nothing that. It's not going to cause unrest. So I'll keep my mouth shut.
Okay. Ominous as always. We'll leave you guys there then. And catch you next time.
Ciao for now.